You're listening to the Outlaw Nation on the Fringe Radio Network. FringeRadioNetwork.com. Your hosts, Eric and Chris, are not responsible for your safety.
Welcome to Outlaw Nation. This is the Ultimate Alchemy Podcast Part 2. And you're listening to us on the Fringe Radio Network. You can find us at fringeradionetwork.com/category/outlaw. You can also reach us at outlawnation7@gmail.com. Or you can find us on Facebook at Outlaw Science. So this is our second installment on alchemy, and I'm your host, Eric, and I have Chris here with me. And so we felt like, you know, we didn't really go into some of the details of symbolism, some of the media that had alchemy references. Chris had some quotes he felt like really expressed the essence of what we were talking about, so he wanted to kind of delve into that and ask me some questions too that we didn't really get around to. So we felt that it was really necessary to do a part two. So Chris, you wanted to start us off with a quote. Why don't you give us the source and take it away?
Sure. It's from an alchemical tract called The New Pearl of Great Price. It says from 1338 AD. It's by Peter Bonus. And here it is. It says, "We have here, as in medicine, practice founded upon sound and well-tested speculative knowledge. And here also, as in medicine, we can be practically successful only if our knowledge be strictly in accordance with the facts of nature. Alchemy is an operative science and produces effects by supplying natural conditions, e.g. by the action of fire. Medicine is either preventive or curative. It either teaches us the conditions of health and instructs as how to avoid disease, or when we are ill, it provides the exact remedy which our disease requires. Alchemy has no need of conservative or preventive action, but it instructs us how to restore and cure, as it were, the diseases of metals, and to bring them back to a state of perfect health, in which state all metals are either silver or gold. The difficulties of our art are great, especially on account of the disagreement which apparently prevails amongst its most authoritative exponents. The second difficulty of our art is that of carrying out practically the clearest and most straightforward printed directions. This difficulty might be got over by watching the operations of some great master, but in the nature of the case, only few can enjoy so high a privilege. The third difficulty consists in the fantastic tricks and absurdly barren devices of fraudulent professors of this art, in consequence of which many find it impossible to believe in the reality of our operations. And the claims of the art itself appear so miraculous and so far exalted above the ordinary course of nature that the vulgar herd are of necessity led to regard the alchemist as a kind of sorcerer or magician, and to place his pretensions in the same class with those of the man who professes to work signs and wonders. These are but a few of the difficulties in which the study of our art is involved, and if there be so many obstacles in the way of its investigation, how much more difficult must be the discovery of its methods? Nevertheless, I stoutly maintain that the art of alchemy is clear and true and founded upon nature, that its products are as truly silver and gold as the precious metals which are produced in the bowels of the earth. There are three parts of philosophy: that which deals with matter in motion, or physics; that which is concerned with matter at rest, or mathematics; and that which abstracts from both matter and motion, or metaphysics. Alchemy belongs neither to the second nor to the third of these departments of science. Consequently, it takes its place in the first department, or that of physical science, for it deals with real being joined to motion and matter, and not with metaphysics, which are divine, and have regard to real being separated from motion and matter. Each physical science deals with a certain division of matter, and so does our magistery. Science is possible by means of the fact that the universe is the work of an intelligence to which our reason corresponds. A little presuppositionalism in there. The divine intelligence has subjected all natural and supernatural phenomena to the rule of certain laws, there you go, which laws our reason was created capable of apprehending, and this state of things is the preliminary condition of all science whatsoever. Our reason is either practical or speculative according to the class of mundane relations with which it deals, and thus we have speculative philosophy or science and practical philosophy or art. Our magistery is speculative insofar as it teaches us the nature and relations of metals. It is practical insofar as it teaches us how to utilize this knowledge for the production of the philosopher's stone and the transmutation of common metals into gold and silver. So I thought that was a really good quote.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know? It's pretty deep. I mean, that's something you need to kind of go back and reread and read and really get, you know, pull all the meaning out of it. I liked your intensity too, Chris. That was very intense. So
I was trying to emphasize, you know, certain parts. Like, if you didn't get that,
no, I got it.
You know, I mean, he flat out tells you, you know, this is a physical science we're dealing with,
right?
You know, and
that was the point of our last podcast. And if it kind of got drowned out in the details. That our entire premise is this is a practical science of real substances.
Yes. And from the words of the alchemists themselves.
From the words of the alchemists themselves. And it's, you know, people have taken this and spiritualized it, and that's fine. I mean, they can do that if they want, but there's really not a long historical precedent for that. And that's why I've kind of remained a practical alchemist and studied practical alchemy all this time. I think its obscurity and its symbolism draws in kind of that new agey feel. But those are symbols that are hiding practical ideas. And that's kind of what we wanted to talk about this time was, you know, what do those symbols mean? And the art of symbolism is really a fascinating subject. One of the things we were talking about right before we started the podcast was how symbols can kind of be fluid. They don't mean necessarily one thing. And sometimes it's hard to grasp what the person that is using the symbol means, okay? Because you have these overlapping symbols. So really, in the study of alchemy, you're trying to uncover what the alchemist meant. And that requires a lot of cross-referencing of symbols, you know, and we'll get into that a little bit here as we talk. But I don't mean cross-referencing the same symbol, but cross-referencing different symbols to see what do they mean by that symbol by comparing it to another symbol. Mm. And that has helped me enormously. And I think that the more symbols you bring into the equation, the more you're going to be able to figure out. And it's also interesting because it overlaps into, mythology, you know, even modern, you know, movies. The alchemists themselves made up symbols and some of these monsters. So, you know, that's the mystique I like. And I think that's where I've spent a lot of my time. And, you know, there are a lot of practical alchemists that spend a lot of time, you know, working on plants. And I actually learned this the other day, Chris. Spagyrix, that's the plant alchemy we talked about last time, just briefly.
Right.
I found a reference to what that term means. And span is Greek for separate. And I might be saying this wrong, but the other Greek root there is agyrein, which means to unite. So it means really to separate and then unite.
Interesting.
And yeah, I thought that was really fascinating because there's another saying called solve a coagula, which means to dissolve and coagulate, which is very similar.
Right.
And so this idea of, you know, separating what's inside and trying to, you know, find that quintessence and then unite it with the sulfur is really what alchemy is all about. So the names bear a lot of examination when you when you're looking at some of the symbols like the, you know, chimera or the salamander. The names themselves were chosen with a reason, and you know, those symbols bear a lot of fruit if you examine what the names mean and tear apart the etymology of the name.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really have an agenda this time. I kind of told you I had a little bit of an outline of some of the symbols that we covered last time, but we didn't go into detail. So we can start there, or we can start with whatever you had next.
Well, I was just going to comment on what you just said about, you know, separating into two, and then because that's really the theme of the operation of alchemy. Just from reading this book, you know, Alchemy Deciphered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say that, you know, you have one substance that you have to separate into two and then, like, I don't know, purify them and then reunite them. Or can you elaborate on that or kind of explain?
Well, purification is very important. I mean, and on different levels. Okay. So one of the things that I feel like I've learned from studying alchemy is that when you're studying these operations,
mm-hmm.
sometimes they won't tell you. You know, alchemists are shifty.
yeah.
They will, you know, in the last podcast we mentioned sometimes they'll outright lie. Most of them will just omit steps.
Right.
Or they won't be very clear with what they're talking about. So sometimes they'll just launch into a metaphor, and they won't tell you if they're talking about, you know, the first operation, the second operation, the third operation. I've come to realize that I believe there's only three operations, and they're very similar. So once you figure out what the main operation is, you can kind of figure out how to proceed. But purification can kind of occur at two levels. So at one level, you're trying to extract this mercury, and when you extract it, depending on how you extract it, it can be either somewhat pure or somewhat dirty, you know, depending on your method of extraction.
Isn't it also the quality of the metal?
Yeah.
Doesn't that affect it?
Yeah, typically the alchemists talk about having pure metals. They talk about, you know, a lot of practical ways to purify metals. It's easy now as a practical alchemist. As a matter of fact, you know, modern alchemists have a lot of advantages. You have electricity.
That's
so you
funny.
You can run multiple experiments at the same time. With hot plates or, kilns or whatever method you think you're going to achieve some results, or just experimenting around. Whereas the Othenor, which we didn't really talk about at all last time, the Othenor was kind of a little kiln that they would feed fire to. Well, it didn't have to be little. It could have been as big as a fire.
Some of them were huge.
Yeah.
I was going to say.
Yeah, some were big fireplaces and they fed a lot wood underneath, and regulating the temperature was, you know, kind of a big deal and very difficult. And so they one of the metaphors they use is at a certain point it becomes as easy as a woman spinning a distaff, and they call it child's play. And I believe what they were really referencing there is the ability to maintain and keep a fire at a certain temperature, because it may take you, you know, months or weeks to achieve what you're trying to achieve, and you need a constant temperature. Well, now you can just flip a switch and, you know, have a pyrometer.
Just keep it regulated.
Yeah. You know, and kind of monitor it. And that's a huge advantage. The other thing is just the ease of obtaining materials. You know, if you want to start with a certain metal, you know, antimony or something. Yeah. Now, that, I believe, is a symbol. Now, in one of the books I mentioned last time, which was the In Pursuit of Gold Alchemy, which I think is an excellent book. The author spends a lot of time talking about antimony, and he thinks that that is actually one of the secrets, you know. I'm not of that opinion, and I came away from that opinion through reading Fulcanelli, because he goes through a lot of the, again, the word etymology of antimony and what it means and why they chose that metal as a symbol for what they are experimenting on, but it's not the metal, you know. It's kind of like that same little blind there where they're saying, well, it's our antimony or it's our gold.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So they don't really mean antimony. And antimony was symbolized by the wolf and the gray wolf. And so a lot of people have taken that color gray and the metaphor of the wolf, and they have, you know, placed it on top of antimony. And, you know, from, you know, our talks on induction, there's a lot of metals that can fit that that small criteria right there. You know, there are a lot of gray, shiny metals, okay? I mean, graphite is a gray, shiny metal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's carbon, primarily, but it's gray and shiny, you know? Actually, I experimented on graphite because I thought it fit some of the criteria, and as I was, you know, speculating about what the mercury was, graphite, you know, had a lot of interesting properties. It was also called coal by the Egyptians, you know, so you kind of have that black coloration, but in its raw state, when it's compressed, graphite is very shiny, kind of like mercury. So you know, there are people that experiment on graphite. I'm not one of them anymore. I think that was a path that, you know, was kind of dead. Anyways, I'm kind of rambling on. But, you know, we have some advantages with not having to keep our Athanor at a consistent temperature, you know, with wood. And, you know, they were at a disadvantage. But the purity of the metals, too, that's what I was going to say, is the purity of the ingredients. So you can just go on eBay and buy something, you know, buy antimony if you want.
Right.
But they didn't have that luxury. You know, they had to, you know, go find somebody that might have some, or go dig it themselves, you know. And if they even knew what antimony was, you know. I mean, they didn't have knowledge about a lot of metals. You know, they didn't know what aluminum was, or they knew about the planetary metals. And we have a lot of, you know, exotic metals now that we almost kind of take for granted. And who knows what those alchemists would have done with it, because I think they knew kind of the essence that they were dealing with. But I think so. They, in some ways, they knew more than we did. But they, you know, modern science has gone a different direction. You know, it's more chemical in nature and more you know, focused on the anatomy of the atoms and you know, chemical reactions and that kind of thing. And the alchemists were more in that vein too. You know, that was more of the metal alchemy, where they were looking to manipulate metals. And so anyways, you know, did that answer your question about purification? Oh, the other level of purification I was going to mention is, once you have the mercury, sulfur is a little different. Now, you know, I can't really give you what a good definition of what sulfur is, but as we go through some of the symbols, it's always related to fire. It has this fiery nature. And from what the alchemists say, its purest form is found in gold, as is mercury.
Right.
So that's why they call, you know, the Philosopher's Stone our gold, because they see it as the perfect purification of mercury and sulfur bound together. And so they call it our gold, because they have kind of artificially recreated gold in its like first state. Okay.
Right.
And that's not like a secret or anything. If you read enough alchemical literature, you'll run across that over and over again.
Yeah.
But You know, it's not something if you pick up any book on alchemy you're going to read in the introduction. You have to dig for that information. So you're welcome, because I just gave you something really cool. No, I'm just joking.
So,
go ahead.
So, when you extract the mercury, are the mercury and the sulfur then extracted out of one substance that's then divided into two?
No, I think they're two different substances, you know, and I think that, you know, as we go through the symbolism, you'll see that. But one of the things I told you that I felt was something that really helped me was...
So by the separate and or the solvate coagula,
mm-hmm.
that so you're extracting the sulfur and the mercury and then uniting them? Is that the meaning
of
that?
Well, you're kind of using the mercury to extract the sulfur. So they have this affinity towards one another. And that's why they're, you know, I believe the first work is finding and extracting the mercury. The second work is similar to the first, but it's more about extracting the sulfur with the mercury. And then the third step, I believe, is maturation of those two. And, you know, so that, and again, I could be wrong. You know, I'm just going on, you know, the 20 years of studying I've done, but, you know, it took me a lot of comparison of things. And I mean, comparison of symbols. The reason that, you know, I've stumbled across a couple of clues, and one of the things that I found out, or at least I believe is a real key, is that the first work, whatever that is, you know, seems to progress from these colors from black to white. And then the second work repeats that. So it's not really the same work. You see this repetition of this color change from black to white. Now, I've been more interested in the dry way. You know, one of the things the alchemists talk about, primarily Fulcanelli, is he mentions in both his books, The Mystery of the Cathedrals, and this is where we kind of have to pause and say, if you didn't listen to part one, we're not going to always go back and repeat everything we did in part one. So if you didn't listen to part one and you don't know what books I'm talking about, then go back and listen.
Go listen to part one.
Right. So, and the other one, The Dwelling of the Philosophers. But he mentions it in both books that there are two ways. There's a dry way, which requires higher heat, and there's a wet way. And, you know, they have symbols around each one, but most alchemists talk about the wet way. So for me, I was kind of constantly trying to translate, I guess, their explanation of the wet way and make it work with dry reactions, you know, because there is an essence there of each way that makes it work. And that's what I was trying to get to the bottom of. For instance, you know, extracting the mercury, it can be done. It's the same substances, but you're either using high heat to do it or you're using low heat and it takes a lot longer, you know? So it just kind of depends.
So what are some of the differences between the dry way and the wet way? Just the heat or what? The time?
I think mostly the time. In Fulcanelli's books, this hasn't been my experience, but again, I think we mentioned in the in part one that there are as many ways to do this as there are days in the year. So I think that people use different substances and different methodologies. And we also talked about how they may not be as efficient, you know. And so, but the dry way is supposed to be much, much shorter, and that's kind of why I chose it, because I think that if you're doing experiments and you're trying to kind of re-engineer some of these things, then you're going to have a higher rate of success if you can, you know, leave something for a week or a couple of days and then look at your results rather than hoping you have the right ingredients and waiting, you know, 18 months or three months or whatever. And the guy in the Pursuit of Gold Alchemy, he mentions that. He's like, you know, have multiple setups. He focuses mostly on the wet way. And, you know, we talked about last time some of the other, you know, paths people have gone, you know, that golden water path and things like that, that try to use the wet way methodology, or at least they explain it as a wet way. So, anyways.
So is that the main difference then between them? One's using ingredients in a liquid form versus
yes.
a solid?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I didn't really clarify that. So the dry way focuses on higher temperatures.
You're using what, mercury in a liquid form versus a solid form?
Or? Yeah, you know, we talked about that a little bit off the air, and mercury's, at least what I think the mercury is kind of weird stuff, you know, I think that the best approach, if somebody's really interested in doing some experiments, is do the research first. Go look at all these different alchemists, see what they say, line
right.
up the descriptions of the mercury, and then, you know, toy around with some things and see, you know, what fits those things. It's something you're going to have to make, and all the alchemists have been clear about that. It's not something that just you're going to find in nature. You can't just pick up a mineral or a metal and say, this is the mercury. And that's something I, you know, didn't realize until about 5 years ago. You know, it's something that the alchemist has to make, because he's doing artificially what takes nature thousands of years. So, you know, the first work is trying to extract the mercury. Once you figure that out, I think your work will go a lot faster. But, you know, I'm using what I think is a mercury. You talk to 10 other alchemists, you're probably going to get 10 different answers. But I believe we're all talking about the same thing. And there is this one salt or quintessence that is, you know, available in almost everything. It's just, where are you going to find it in abundance, and how are you going to extract it? You know, so that's why I'm a little leery of calling even this, you know, the stuff about Ormus and stuff. I don't think that's the right way at all. These guys that are doing the white gold method. But I'm still a little hesitant to say they're wrong, because even the substance they're using, you know, does contain this mercury. So, you know, if somebody could use that methodology and stumble upon the mercury, who am I to say they can't do that? But I just don't think that the results that they're getting are the Philosopher's Stone. It doesn't meet the criteria. Unless all these people are suddenly growing young and making a bunch of gold, I don't think they did it, you know.
Right.
So, for me, that's the final, you know, that's the final test. And the alchemists will say that, you know, if you can transmute one substance into another, then you know what you have is real. And that was kind of the way they would test it. The end result wasn't gold. The end result was trying to make a medicine for human consumption. But, you know, if you had something that could transmute it, that was a good, or transmute base metals into precious metals, that was a really good indication that you had the right stuff. So,
right.
You know, one of the things we didn't really talk about last time was, you know, what you can do with the Philosopher's Stone. That might be something we can talk about at the end.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'll write that down here so we can talk about maybe some of the qualities and why people sought this thing, you know.
Well, here's the comment just on, you're talking about the mercury. There's this part in this book, like we mentioned in the first part, Alchemy Deciphered. He's talking about, he says, the ingredient is known to all people. This is on page 263, just for people listening. And there's a bunch of quotes, you know, from alchemists. Like this one says, there is something which everyone recognizes, and whoever does not recognize it will rarely, perhaps never, find it. The wise man will keep it, and the fool will throw it away, and the reduction comes easily to the man who knows it. Anonymous, a magnificent and select tract on philosophical water, 13th to 7th century. Another one, know that our mercury is before the eyes of all men, though it is known to few. When it is prepared, its splendor is most admirable, but the sight is vouchsafed to none, save the sons of knowledge. Do not despise it, therefore, when you see it in sordid guise, for if you do, you will never accomplish our magistery, and if you can change its countenance, the transformation will be glorious. For our water is a most pure virgin, and is loved of many, but meets all her wooers in foul garments, in order that she may be able to distinguish the worthy from the unworthy. So that was from Irenaeus Philatheles.
I always have a trouble with his name too. Philatheles, I think that's okay. As close as I can get. Yeah.
Yeah, the Fount of Chemical Truth, 1694 AD. So basically, this ingredient is supposedly known to everyone. It's basically hidden in plain sight.
Yeah.
It's extremely common, but it's basically nobody thinks anything of it because it's, I guess it's so common or so, you know.
Well, that quote you read, I think it's more designed to confuse than it is to reveal.
Okay.
You know those kind of statements aren't very helpful. At least not to me. Because, you know, just through my own scientific endeavors, you know, I'm trying to pick out clues there. There's so many possibilities there, you know? I mean...
Right.
There's really not... So I feel like they're almost kind of winking at each other, but they're not really revealing that much. And, you know, if I think it is what... You know, or if I know what it is, and I'm correct, then I understand why they're saying that. But it doesn't really help somebody who's just starting off in the science. And
no, inductively, it would be. I mean, that's
it could be anything, you know.
Right? Yeah.
But I think in generally, you know, generally, I'll go back to what I said in the first podcast, which is, you know, you're looking at this, and my opinion is this stuff is all around us. Because it's really what they're talking about is the ethers, okay? And I talked a little bit about ether science and these different scientists that have been experimenting with ethers for decades, but they call it different names, you know. And so in one sense, you could kind of interpret what that guy was saying in that sense, you know, that this quintessence is all around us. And if you know how to extract it out of certain substances, then you'll have what you desire, you know. And that's why I don't think what he's saying is really revealing. You know, but one of the symbols is, I mean, I think you're going to eventually start talking about the secret fire, you know, and that I believe is what this, and we mentioned that in the first podcast, the secret fire, I believe, is this ether, you know. And I'm going to dive a little bit into symbolism here because, you know, one of the Lord of the Rings, symbols we didn't talk about really was smog. Well, we talked a little bit about it, but I didn't really get that into it. And because all the colors of alchemy are there, so you have the black arrow that pierces pierces the dragon. See, and that dragon represents that secret fire. And you have a lot of dragon metaphors. And you know, the salamander is a dragon of fire.
Right.
The python.
It's
kind of associated with fire that Cadmus pins against the tree.
St. George and the Dragon.
You have Jason, you know, fighting. I think he fought the Hydra.
Right, yeah.
You know, so you have these different dragon metaphors, and that dragon is, I believe, the secret fire. At least it's the sulfur, okay? I thought this was interesting because, you know, I was talking about the interpretation of names, but you know, I think that J.R.R. Tolkien put things in his works on purpose because he either knew about the symbolism or he knew some of the keys and decided to put them in his works. You don't have to understand all the keys to use them. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If you understand the consistency of the symbols, then you can just kind of throw them in there. But smog literally means, you know, to squeeze through a hole. And it's a kind of a low philological jest that they used in German, old German. But I think that there's kind of an alchemical statement there because, first of all, you know, we talked about last time how he's protecting the Arkenstone or the Holy Stone. In the movie, at least, it's a white stone. And that kind of summarizes all those colors there, the red dragon, the white stone, and the black arrow. You have the three colors of alchemy there. You have the slaying of the dragon, which is in all the different stories. And then you have this other little kind of clue that he knew something, which is the squeezing through the hole of the mountain there. And that's, I think...
Was the mountain the earth?
Right, right. It kind of has that same meaning as the Sword and the Stone, something that you're drawing out of the earth, you know.
I see, yeah.
So that's the way I interpret it.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and there's other, you know, I mean, Tolkien was a...
I mean, Smaug literally lived in the bowels of the earth.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what Tolkien, you know, was very familiar with Old English and Saxon and Old German, and, you know, so he was not probably unaware of some of these different meanings for dragons. And, you know, one of them was Priften, which means fireworm in Welsh.
Mm-hmm.
Tragu, which also means to burrow into the ground, you know. So whether you believe those were representative of real creatures at one time or if the, you know, but to the alchemists, they were looking at these symbols and kind of latching on to them because they were, you know, giving like some hidden meaning to their work. And that's why they liked those symbols.
Right.
Another symbol that you'll see a lot pop up is the red man and the white wife, which we barely touched on.
Mm-hmm.
And just so we can kind of continue with this Lord of the Rings, hey, there's some real little tidbits here that I think you'll enjoy, Chris. So, one of the ones we didn't talk about, because we did talk about the battle at Khazad Dûm, okay, with Gandalf and the Balrog, which I think is still one of my favorite symbols, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot communicated there, especially when he's standing there saying, I am the servant of the secret fire, okay.
Right,
you know,
right.
That's not an accident.
No.
But an overlooked one is this interaction between Galadriel and Gimli, because she's the white wife and he's kind of the representative of the red man. And, you know, the dwarves are kind of these, you know, men of the earth and ruddy. And
But
there's a scene that's in the book, and they didn't put it in the original movie, but they did in the extended version. It's called The Giving of the Gifts. And what she gives Gimli is three hairs from her... What her hair is described as gold. So you have...
Interesting.
You have the red man, the white wife interacting, and then you have the number three represented as the three operations, and then...
the Philosopher's Stone.
Right.
The gold.
And the Philosopher's Stone represented as gold, you know.
Huh.
I also see it in the marriage between the king and the queen, Aragorn.
Yeah,
the
elf lady.
Yep.
Yeah. Huh.
Both their names have significant meaning, too. His name, Aragorn, means Lord of the Tree. So remember we talked about the oak tree having, you know, some meaning there. And then Arwen, now, it means Even Star. Now, in the book, her name is Even Star. Arwen means Even Star. I think in the movie, though, they made it... the Even Star was a jewel, and the book talks about this jewel, but it calls it the Elf Stone. I think it even has a name, Elisar, I think it is. But what's interesting is the description of this gem or this necklace that's in the book. So it's a I'm just going to read it. It was a green gem set on a silver eagle shaped brooch. It had the light of the sun within it, and those who looked through it saw everything that was aged and withered as young once more.
Wow.
So, I mean, you know, one of the properties of Philosopher's Stone is supposed to be to, you know, forestall, you know, aging and
right.
restore youth. And, you know, if you look at the whole idea of the light of the sun or that energy of the sun, we were talking about, like, you know, EMFs being able to move the ethers and that kind of thing, then, you know, it's really pretty telling there.
I heard the Philosopher's Stone described as a congealed sunlight before.
Yeah. Yeah. Where'd you get that one?
I actually don't remember, but I remember that description.
Well, you know, I think we mentioned this book. I'm not sure if we mentioned the experiment in it, but in the Rosicrucian Notebook by Willy Schroeder.
It might have been that.
I think I did mention this. They had that room full of mirrors, and then they had this golden ball in the middle, and then they would shine the sun, you know, or reflect the light of the sun off the mirrors onto this gold ball, and then this liquid would form on the gold ball.
That should say a lot about what the mercury is if it's in the sunlight.
Right. You know? Right. Exactly. And I think that is a fair description.
Something very subtle. Yeah.
It's subtle, and I think it exists in pretty much everything. It's just where you're going to find it in the most abundance to use it. You know, the alchemists even talk about sulfur and mercury kind of being this, you know, different sides of the same coin, like it's the same substance, but it's
right.
Yep.
I was just on. Hold on a sec. Yeah, right here on page 144 of the Alchemy Deciphered, it says it follows the principle of yin-yang.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the quotes, these two substances, which are of the same nature but of two different sexes, embrace each the other with the self-same love and satisfaction as do man and woman.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and you see that duality all over in nature, so it's...
Right.
It's hard to ignore that. I can't really wrap my head around what these substances actually are. I just believe it's a solid form of the ethers, and it manifests into...
In a passive and an active, or a masculine and a feminine?
Yeah, masculine. I think binary. Masculine and feminine are the best way to describe them, you know. But they're actual substances, you know.
Right, right.
So we already talked about... Did you have any more questions about the Balrog and the... And Gandalf symbols, and we kind of covered that pretty thoroughly last time. I didn't know if there were any lingering questions about that symbol.
No, I think I'm good on that.
One of the symbols is another one that's one of my favorites is the griffin,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
you'll see this expounded upon quite a bit in Fulcanelli's works. But the interesting thing there is the makeup of the griffin. I like simple symbols because I think they communicate almost more than complex symbols.
Right.
And the griffin has the head of an eagle and the body of a lion. So the idea there is the eagle is...
Is that the mercury and the sulfur?
Yeah, it is. It's the combination of those two. But what you're seeing there in the eagle is the volatile principle, or that idea of volatility.
Right.
And that's always expressed with wings. And
right.
We can get into the caduceus a little later, too, because the caduceus was Hermes' symbol. And Hermes is really the founder of, you know, what the alchemists say is the founder of alchemy and the kind of the keeper of the alchemical secrets.
Do they mean the god Hermes or Hermes Trismegistus?
Hermes Trismegistus. Okay. I have as much problem with it.
Well, I guess sometimes those two probably get conflated because no one actually knows who Hermes Trismegistus was, if he was even a real person.
Exactly. And I didn't mention this in the first podcast, but there is a highly esoteric work called the Emerald Tablet.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. I wanted to ask you about that, what your thoughts on that.
I mean, it's very difficult to interpret unless you have a couple of the keys already worked out.
It's like impossible.
And a lot of people have, you know, I've seen it referenced in almost every alchemical website or book, and except for probably a few authors, they almost always get it wrong because the symbols they're complex, you know.
Yeah.
And if you have the if you've already drawn the conclusion inductively that it's a spiritual alchemy, you're going to misinterpret the symbols because you're going to place your own interpretation on there.
Begging the question, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You're affirming the consequent there, you know. Mm-hmm. You've already determined what that symbol means, and you're just kind of, you know, confirming it to yourself.
Reasoning in a circle, yeah.
Yeah. The griffin... here, I think I have a little quote here by Fulcanelli. Let me on the griffin. Well, thought I could turn right to it. I have a lot of bookmarks here, so.
Mm-hmm.
But the other one that's a related symbol is the chimera.
Yeah.
And the chimera, you know, has the head of a lion, the head of a dragon, the head of a goat, and the tail of a snake. And now I believe that symbol, that monster, was something that was created by medieval alchemists. I'm not 100% sure on that. I haven't really looked into the actual development of that symbol.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you can go back really that far. There may be other chimeras that are described in like Greek mythology.
That's what I was thinking of. Yeah,
I think the ones described by the alchemists is different, and they're using those heads to actually communicate.
Right.
So the goat is actually the most difficult ones, the difficult one because it is, you know, kind of obscure. But the goat. Is definitely the mercury. The lion we kind of already identified in other symbols as the sulfur. Mm-hmm. And the dragon is that secret fire again, that kind of relates to both of them. But they're all embedded into this one body, so these symbols kind of get conflated a little bit. You know, they're...
Why do you think the goat is the mercury, just by process of elimination, or...?
Yeah, a little bit, but also by its color gray.
Okay.
Gray, typical of the... has to do with the wet. Remember, we talked about the wet fire last time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Gray definitely has to do with the wet fire.
Okay.
So there's other symbols that kind of led me to that conclusion. The tail of the snake actually is something I kind of go back and forth on, but it, you know, you have the dragon and head, and then you have this tail that's a snake. It kind of is reminiscent of the Aurora Boris, which is a snake eating its own tail.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I really love that symbol, mainly for its simplicity. You know, it's always been a symbol of infinity.
Yeah.
But one of the things that the alchemists describe is the, you know, if see they believe this is all really kind of one substance. So they're saying that this substance makes itself stronger. You know, so if you take gold and you take the mercury, a purified philosophical mercury, and you add it to gold, it should melt the gold and turn it into more philosophical mercury, you know.
Right.
And that's one of the arts of multiplication, is to take this stuff and make more of it, so you don't run out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, there's other methodologies described in that book, Alchemy Deciphered, about how to, you know, make it stronger in quality and quantity.
But, yes.
I guess what I was trying to say there is that... what was I trying to say, Chris?
You were talking about the snake, the dragon, what you thought the snake was.
The Aurora Boris, okay? So
right.
It's eating its own tail. So really, the Philosopher's Stone is supposed to be able to eat all the other metals. That's kind of why they use that symbol. That's what I was getting at. So it's said to re-include gold into its first state.
Right.
And you also see it in the metaphor of the king being bathing in his own blood. I know that's kind of a darker symbol, but you do see that. There's another one called the Massacre of the Innocents, you know. So sometimes the alchemists want, you know, super dark, but those symbols all have similar meanings. And but they're just trying to communicate this blood, this elixir, can re-include the metals. And so it eats itself, and it makes itself stronger.
Right.
In a way. So that's why you have that symbol. So it doesn't just have to mean an eternity. Fulcanelli goes into what Aurora Boris means quite a bit, like the meaning of the word and everything. Let's see. I was going to go down a little bit. So I think that's what the snake is representing there, is kind of that feeling of Aurora Boris, or that circular nature of the dragon and the snake.
I see.
I could be wrong on that. I mean, that's just my interpretation on it. I've never heard of a better one, so that's the one I'm kind of sticking with right now.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to the griffin, see, the lion loses his head, and usually what that means is that you've changed that terrestrial substance somehow. So the eagle is the volatile principle, and combines with the lion. So what you've done is you've fundamentally changed both substances to form a new substance. See, that's the rebus, the two thing.
Right.
You'll sometimes seen it described as the hermaphrodite because it has a male and female head,
right,
in one body. And see, we look at those symbols as a modern person and go, "Oh, that's gross." You know, I don't like that symbol. You know, again, they were using those symbols to communicate something, not to be gross. But I like the more elegant symbol of something like the griffin rather than the hermaphrodite for obvious reasons. You know,
right.
one of the ones that I that overlaps with this griffin too is the salamander and the remora. Now we get that story from Cyrano de Bergerac, and he has a short little story about these two animals. One's an animal of fire, one's an animal of ice, and they battle each other. The remora always wins. And then the alchemist takes the two eyes of the salamander and then merges them back into one, which is very esoteric in meaning, but very significant. But what I want to say about the remora is the remora traditionally is a fish. Okay, it's actually, you know, and you have seen these fish that latch on to like the bottom of a shark and kind of go for a ride, kind of a parasite.
Yeah.
Well, I guess some native people, and I learned this a long time ago, what they would do is they would tie a rope onto the tail of the remora, and they would fish with a fish. And the alchemists definitely loved that symbol, this idea of fishing for a fish in the sea, kind of this cosmic sea of energy, you know. They're using a fish to fish for a fish, okay? And so that's why I think they use the remora for their mercury, is you're looking in this sea for that quintessence to extract out. And so, you know, I kind of see it as a series of different extractions you have to make. You know, once you use one substance to extract another substance, and you use that substance to extract another substance. So it's kind of a progression. And, you know, that's just for one methodology. I'm not saying that, you know, every alchemist is going to go down that path. That's just, you know, one of the interpretations I've had, and some of the experiments that I've done seem to point to that. So, anyways, I really like that symbol, the salamander remora. Here, let me read this little section about the salamander and remora. This is from Fulcanelli's book, Dwellings of the Philosophers. It's in the chapter of the Castle of Dampierre. Cyrano de Bergerac stages two fantastic beings represented in the principles of sulfur and mercury, issuing from the four primary elements. The sulfurous salamander, which thrives in the midst of flames, symbolizes the air and fire of the sulfur. In the midst of the flames, symbolizes the air and fire, of which the sulfur possesses the dryness and the igneous ardor. And the remora, the mercurial champion, air to the earth and water by its cold and humid qualities. Remember, I was going back to that gray color representing the wet fire. So he's repeating that here. See, this is why, you know, you really have to do a lot of studying and compare the symbols. And that's why I find it so fascinating. These names chosen on purpose owe nothing to whim or fancy. Salamandra in Greek seems formed of sal, or salt, the anagram for alls, salt, and of mandra, stable, is the salt of the stable, the salt of urine of the artificial saltpeter, the saltpeter of the old spagyrus, salpetri, salt of stone. So again, when you have alchemists talking about saltpeter, in normal chemical, you know, common language, that's an actual substance. But it's not to the alchemist, in my opinion. The alchemists were using saltpeter as another symbol. They were saying, that's the salt of the stone.
Right.
So they were using a lot of these different word plays to communicate the same thing. And people mistook what they were saying and went off on these tangents, you know. And so they would use things like saltpeter to conduct their experiments. which they still... So saltpeter, salt of stone, which they still designate under the name of dragon. The remora in Greek, echinus, is this famous fish which was supposed to stop, according to some, or to direct, according to others, ships sailing in northern seas, subject to the influence of the North Star. It is the echinus of which the cosmopolite speaks, that's another alchemist, the royal dolphin which the characters of the Mutus Liber, that's the silent book that we mentioned in the last podcast, exerts themselves to the capture. The one, the alchemical furnace of Fau at the Winterthur Museum, represents the same one which accompanies and pilots on the bas-relief ornamenting the fountains of Verbeuil, the ship loaded with an enormous hewn stone. The echinus is the pilot of the running waters, our Mercury, the faithful friend of the alchemist, the one which has to absorb the secret fire, the igneous energy of the salamander, and finally remains stable. So, remember when he said salt of urine or salt of the stable?
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about a stable salt, not the salt of urine, okay? Hmm. So something that's was volatile, now remains terrestrial. That's my interpretation. Mm-hmm. So this is why you have to really kind of read between the lines and compare these symbols. These two principles of opposite natures and tendencies of contrary disposition exhibit a relentless antipathy against each other and an irreducible aversion for one another. Face to face, they furiously attack each other, defend themselves ruthlessly, and the truceless and merciless fight only ceases with the death of one of the antagonists. Such is the esoteric duel, appalling yet real, which the illustrious Cyrano relates in these terms. So then he goes on to actually quote the whole thing from Cyrano de Bergerac. But I think it's interesting because there are a lot of symbols that have this battle. Okay, the battle theme is very, very common. They'll talk about the battle between the fox and the cock.
Right.
You know, and so you see that interplay of two opposite sides of the same coin battling. And so, anyways, I felt like I was a little bit of on a rant there. So, was there another question you had? There's a couple more symbols here I had in my notes, but
Let's see. I might have some symbols. So the body and the soul. Have we talked about those?
Not really, but it's kind of the same
body,
concept.
Soul, spirit.
Yeah,
we can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's that same concept. You know, the soul. Is kind of the essence that you're looking for. The body is definitely something you're extracting from, you know, the mercury from, I'm sorry, the sulfur from.
And the spirit is the mercury?
Well, yes. Yeah, and I think this is one reason I haven't really liked the description of body, soul, and spirit. It didn't seem to... it's one of the symbols I don't see fitting that neatly, you know. Maybe I just don't understand the symbols. And this is where, you know, if I think it is what I think it is, then I can make those symbols say whatever I want, you know. How you guys wouldn't really know the difference.
Right.
You know. But I'll be flat out honest with you. I don't know which one's which with that symbol. I think the body typically represents, the terrestrial substances that you're going to draw the mercury from. And then the spirit is definitely represented by something you're going to capture.
Mm-hmm.
And then the soul is kind of what you end up making out of it. I mean, that's a really poor kind of analysis of those symbols.
You don't think the soul's the sulfur? It's fiery and passionate? I don't know.
Yeah, that's as good an explanation as any, Chris. I mean,
yeah. I think of a soul, I think of like your emotions, your fiery, passionate aspect, and then like the spirit's like the part that animates you, you know, that airy quality. So that'd be the mercury. The soul's more how do I say it? I guess masculine. You know, it's more passionate, you know.
Right.
You could say that'd be the sulfur.
Yeah, I think that's a great explanation.
The body. I don't know what's the body then? Think that is the earthy quality, but I don't know what that would be in relation to the.
Right. And I think that, you know, for me, the body, soul, spirit, you know, symbolism is a little confusing. Mm-hmm. But I think that you'll see alchemists mention that, and that's what leads people down this kind of esoteric road to spiritualize some of these things, you know.
Right.
Because I think there are descriptions of those. You know, I was mentioning in a book, I don't recommend this book, it's called The Philosopher's Stone by Israel Righardi, and I was telling Chris earlier that this has one good chapter in it that I've, you know, was rereading the other day, and but what it was is a reprint of an actual practical alchemist work, you know. And so then he would go on and give a commentary as to what they think, you know, in kind of a Jungian sense that these different things are. For instance, it says, clearly this stone represents the union of mercury, which is consciousness, and sulfur, the fire of emotion, the anima principle of the psyche, using salt as their basis of action, the astro-mental sheath. So, I mean, you know, how do you know that? I mean, you know,
it's ironic because they're interpreting the symbolism of the alchemists with the symbolism.
Right.
When the alchemists themselves said these symbols are meant to you know, blind an actual physical science.
Right.
I just find that that's bizarre.
There is a sense. I mean, in a Christian sense, there is this idea that, you know, God has made everything in a certain way, and so that all things are kind of interrelated, and so, you know, they may not be that far off. I don't trust their methodology, and
right.
I think that from what you know, you and I have been reading, it fits with what the alchemists say. So, you know, why use that? But there is kind of this esoteric saying, as above, so below, and alchemists use that too, because, you know, they're trying to recreate what they believe the methodology was that God used to create everything to begin with, you know.
Right.
So, but there are different, I guess, transformations, if you want to use that in a general sense. You could say that there's, you know, transformations in culture and, you know, the way humans have developed or devolved, I guess. Or the way, you know, I'm kind of at a loss there, but people are using this idea of alchemy in a general sense of transformation in different ways, and they're not totally wrong to do that. Mm-hmm. It's just that's not really the way the practical alchemists of the West had intended. So,
well, there are actually a lot of passages like that in the Bible where God's like describing how he disciplines you. Like he actually uses imagery, like, you know, refining you. Like,
oh, exactly. Yeah. And that's a great point.
Refining really, your fire.
It reminds me of a great book. And this is a book I highly recommend. If you're a young Christian and you're listening to this, if you want to take one thing away from this podcast, go out and get a book called A Shepherd's Look at Psalm 23. It's a great devotional book. You read through that. And the whole premise of the book is that God made this kind of real life analogy between shepherds and sheep, and this guy was a shepherd that wrote the book, and he relates on how stupid sheep are and how stubborn sheep are directly to the relationship of the shepherd and how many things a real shepherd has to do. But he goes through line by line in Psalm 23 and shows how that relationship between shepherd and sheep is real in a real agricultural sense, and he relates it to that passage. It's an excellent read. It goes back to that whole idea that there's a lot of typology in the Bible, and God uses a lot of those types to explain his relationship with us, you know. So, little shout out to some biblical information there.
So what about the Holy Grail, then?
You know, I was afraid you were going to ask me about that. Man, I was looking for the reference. But, you know, again, that's one – that's a story you see repeated because it's not just the sword and the stone, which we covered a little bit, but it's also the story of Arthur and Guinevere and Lancelot.
Right.
So you have the –
yeah.
And that is a – that's a symbol that plays out quite a bit where you have this triangle, this love triangle. And you see that played out in a lot of stories that aren't alchemical in any way, but you have that love triangle between the lover and the woman, and then you have the king who ends up, you know, dying.
Right.
And those are all symbols of, again, the mercury and the sulfur, which are represented by the lover and the woman and their union. And then what they do is they form a union that ends up killing the king, and the king is represented by gold. The Holy Grail is really the end result. You know, that's what I was looking for, is that reference to what grail means literally in the language that relates to the Philosopher's Stone. I just couldn't find it, and it was perfect. I was scouring this book called Hidden Symbols of Alchemy and the Occult Arts, and it has it in there, and that's a great book. It's not really one I recommend, but it has a great explanation, or at least a little quote in here about another symbol that we kind of touched on with the dragon symbology, and this kind of goes into kind of our second part here, which is the symbols that are in some of these movies. So I might as well just say it. I'm kind of jumping ahead a little bit. In some of the Harry Potter books and in the movies, you have that symbol of the basilisk.
Right.
And that's the same symbol as the beast of fire, you know, the dragon or the remora. And, you know, what he has as a fire, I think he literally was breathing fire, wasn't he?
In the basilisk? I don't think so. No. He didn't.
I'm remembering something wrong. Well, the fire is kind of in the venom, then, I guess.
Yeah. He had venom. I remember that. Yeah.
But he does battle with the phoenix, if you remember. And what does the phoenix do? The phoenix
plucks out his eye.
Plucks out his eyes.
Right.
Okay. That's the same symbol there as the salamander in Cyrano de Bergerac's, where the eyes are the only thing left of the salamander.
Interesting.
Yeah. Hmm. And you also have that metaphor, and this is in the second movie, I think. The I'm not that familiar with the the
movie. Yeah, I'm not.
The Chamber of Secrets. There we
okay,
go.
Yeah.
So, you know, they have to go down into the earth again, you know, to find this thing. And Harry Potter is his name being Potter. They often call the alchemist a Potter. You know, so he, in a lot of different ways, is the alchemist going through these different stories. And getting back to the basilisk. So I'll just read this quote here. Paracelsus begins with the fact that putrefaction transforms all things into their first shape and is the beginning of generation and multiplication. The spagyric, one of the names for alchemy, from span and agyrein, I think I already mentioned that, unite, art is able to create men and monsters. Such a monster is the basilisk. The basilisk grows and is born out of and from the greatest impurity of women, namely from the menstrua and from the blood that is put into a glass and a cucurbit and putrefied in a horse's belly. Okay. So they're giving a really kind of weird symbol there. They're trying to say this is how it was, the basilisk creature was created. So that's kind of an old wives' tale of how it was created. But the alchemists use this as a symbol of putrefaction, okay? Mm-hmm. And putrefaction is another symbol that has to do with destruction and extraction, okay? So they're talking about putrefaction. Is the basilisk born? Whoever is so daring and so fortunate as to make it, or to take it out, or again to kill it, who does not clothe and protect himself before his mirrors. I advise no one, but I wish to give sufficient warning. The belief, too, was general that this terrible animal was produced from a hen's egg. Herein lies, again, the idea of unnatural procreation. Now the generation of the homunculus is not to be forgotten. So he's... the generation of the basilisk is really what he was getting at more there. Taking obscure substances. I'm not going to... those were kind of gross metaphors, but... So that's the kind of the origin of the basilisk, taking this wives' tale and then turning it into an alchemical symbol. So, but you can see, you know, there it's literally just staring you right in the face in that movie. And in the first movie, it's, I mean, she has this obvious theme right from the start. I mean, the first movie is called, or the first book is called...
Sorcerer's Stone.
Sorcerer's Stone, you know. Or the Philosopher's Stone. And,
right.
They call it the Sorcerer's Stone in England. But there's an interesting, not really a love triangle, but an interesting triangle there with Harry Potter, Hermione, and Ron.
Ron, right.
So Hermione is a female form of Hermes. So she obviously represents the Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't come up with this, by the way. There are actually a couple of websites that go through some of this alchemical symbolism. I spotted it before I ran into that, but when I went looking for it, there are other people that already noticed this. And Ron is a red-haired boy, and you know, he's the red man. And if you remember, at the end of the whole series, Hermione and Ron get married. So you have the marriage of the red man and the white wife.
Right.
And Harry Potter, again, being that alchemist that's performing this, you know, ultimate work in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other symbols I saw there were the three important characters in Harry's life are Sirius Black, Albus Dumbledore, and Rubius Hagrid.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have Black. Albus means white, literally. And Rubius means red. So you have the Black, white, and red, the colors of alchemy, but you also have Sirius Black and Dumbledore dying, which also represents a part of the work, where those substances die, and the only one remaining is Rubius, or the red.
Right, yeah.
You asked me about the Grail. Well, that's also represented there, too, in the Triwizard Cup.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
See, so you have that Grail metaphor there. And they have these trials of fire and water first. So you have the dragon trial first.
Uh-huh.
And the second one, they have to go into water and save a friend.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then the last one is the confusion of the maze. Now, the maze is a very significant symbol. You'll run across it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Or the labyrinth. You'll see it in the story of Ariane, the spider.
Ariande, or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, Ariande, I'm sorry. Yep. And then, you know, so it remains at the center of the web, and Fulcanelli goes through the whole etymology of the words there. But you have that maze that, you know, what happens to the wizards there is they all get confused, and the maze confuses them, and they end up, you know, kind of almost going into a trance, you know. And in some ways, that's representative of this walk the alchemist has to go through. Because you're going to go down blind alleys. You're going to go... that's why they like that symbol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, getting to the center of the maze is not easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't even get into the names of the people that were involved. But you have two men and a woman there. And one's a Fleur de Calure, I think is her name. But she represents a lily, which is another representation of the Philosopher's Stone. A white, usually the lily's white, so she's the mercurial symbol there. Then you have the that one Russian guy. I think there's more there in the names I haven't really examined. So, and ultimately, you know, you have that one boy dying.
Right.
So, and who emerges on the other side? Well, you have Harry emerging on the other side. You know, intact. But he had to go through some trials. So there's some metaphors there. I mean, sometimes you know you don't want to. What's hard is to kind of restrain yourself and not force metaphors.
Right.
The destruction of the book, though, in that, you know, with the basilisk fang.
Is, yeah. Yeah.
The book plays very prominently in alchemical symbolism. The opening of the book or the closing of the book. Usually the closed books represent substances that haven't been worked on yet, and open books represent substances that have been worked on or something that's been extracted out of them. So, you know, at first he destroys the open book and then he destroys the closed book, you know. You could make something into that. But the book I don't want to ignore because it's an important symbol there. And I don't know if J.K., you know, Rowling did that on purpose or not, but it's definitely, you know, using the basilisk fang to destroy the book, to me, is very alchemical. Using the poison of the basilisk, the poison being, you know, that combination of mercury and sulfur, or just a purified mercury to destroy the book. So,
what is the book? What does the book represent then?
Again, it's a substance that they would try to open, you know.
Oh, okay.
So it could represent gold or another metal or something. You know?
I see. Uh-huh.
So, but that's kind of all the work I've done on that. There were a couple other movies that really interested me, too. One was Snow White and the Huntsman. And just the whole fairy tale of Snow White has a lot of alchemical themes in it, even before they made the movie. But so that's one that is just, you know, rife with alchemical metaphors. And so here, I'll start you off with a couple. So you have Snow. She's very mercurial. The way she's described, what her mom, the queen, wishes for is, she says this: "If only I had a child as white as snow, as red as blood, and as black as the wood is in the frame."
Wow.
So, Snow White
colors.
Is the three colors right there, all in one sentence, you know, and that was her prayer. And so she's born, she has skin as white as snow, ribs as red as blood, and black as, you know, raven's feathers, you know. But at the very beginning of the movie, what do you see? You see three drops of blood, and blood is another one of those metaphors for
the stone,
the elixir, or the philosophical, you know, mercury. And you know, it goes back to the Ouroboros or you know, being able to bathe in its own blood. But three, remember, is an important stage.
Right.
This is something I pulled from somebody that I was going to give him credit for it, but I've seen it repeated too many times on the internet, and so its provenance is a little unknown. So I didn't want to give anybody false credit for it, but this is what I found. It said, "Snow White is the philosophical orphan traveling through the three stages. The negrito, or black, is her loss of home and self-identification in the forest. That labyrinthine fairy tale symbol for peril, liminal space, and the transmigration between worlds. The albedo is her time with the seven dwarves." And I think we mentioned the past podcast that seven is a very prominent number. There's seven rungs of a ladder, seven eagles that Fulcanelli describes. So it's part of the creation of the philosophical mercury that ends up in the white stage. Okay. And the number seven has so much symbolism surrounding it, there's not enough space to even mention it here. She's reached an equilibrium and can be herself without the threat and the shadow of the forest. The end of the calm, the white stage, is signified by the arrival of the queen crone, and specifically an apple that's half white and half red. Snow White bites the red half and becomes as if dead. So she puts into a coffin, or she's put into a coffin that's decorated with gold lettering. The philosophical orphan is buried to wait for the completion of the red stage. Enter a prince, the union of opposites, and the alchemical wedding, and the completion of the great work. I thought that was really pretty interesting, because that's taking it from the fairy tale perspective, not even getting into the movie. But you go into the movie, it's kind of a mishmash of symbols. I don't know if there's any real sequence to them, but you have Ravenna as the evil queen.
Mm-hmm.
So she represents the crow, the black color. You see her bathing in that bathing in the milk.
Right. Yeah.
See, that to me is very telling, because that is actually what I think they're talking about there with the multiplication of the stone. You get to the black stage,
I see.
You are feeding it
right
with the milk or the mercury.
Right.
And mm-hmm. that's developing it. You know, mm-hmm. that's what they talk about, solve and coagulate.
Mm-hmm.
So you dissolve mm-hmm. it initially, and then coagulate implies that you're drawing something in, or you're growing it in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you also have her mirror on the wall. If you remember, it kind of folds out into this gold-shaped hooded figure.
Yeah, yeah.
And eventually, she's killed by Snow White and replaced. And what happens? Life is restored. The land is restored.
Mm-hmm.
And so Snow White gives back life that Ravenna took. So.
Mm.
I'm not going to go really deep into this one, but it's one I found, and I've looked for it online, and so I can honestly say I found this. And this is a really deep a symbol that was buried in Limitless. And for those of you that haven't seen it, Limitless is a movie about this guy that gets this kind of experimental drug, and it makes him super smart.
Mm-hmm.
And do you remember that movie, Chris?
Yeah. Yep. I mean, it kind of just has a overt alchemical, theme there,
Yeah, of kind of transforming into something
mm-hmm.
better.
Him ingesting something and him being transformed into some superhuman.
Yeah, exactly. You know? So, you remember that scene in the coffee shop where the guy is borrowing money from the loan shark?
Uh-huh.
And they're sitting in the booth, and he's kind of examining his watch, and they kind of do this quick flash to different parts of the loan shark, like he's sizing him up real quick,
Uh-huh.
And the necklace the loan shark is wearing is an incredible alchemical symbol. So what he's wearing around his neck, I actually had to freeze frame it and examine it, because it went by me so fast. But he has this necklace that's made of a white dice, a alchemical symbol, the literal alchemical symbol for copper. It's like these three bars with an X through it.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, he has an Ankh, which is an Egyptian symbol for eternal life. And so what you have in the dice is you have the white dice, which white in a sense... almost always, white or gray to me always represent some kind of mercurial substance, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the six sides, there's actually a lot of different symbolism around dice. I couldn't find it, but I know I've run across it in the past. Fulcanelli talks about the dice and the cube. The cube actually is a pretty prominent symbol. And you'll see that represented in things like the Transformers. You have the cube.
All right, yeah.
Gives things life. You also see it in 2010. I don't think they call it the cube, but the obelisk that gives life to planets,
mm-hmm.
And or Space Odyssey 2001 also. That's definitely kind of a symbol for the Philosopher's Stone. In its black stage.
You see it in the Avengers, too, the Tesseract.
Oh, I forgot about that one. That's a great one.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah, it kind of has that inner fire in it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yep.
So you see that theme repeated over and over again.
Why do you think it would be symbolized by a cube? What is the significance of the four?
Well, the cube is six, actually. So there's, there's six sides.
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's related to the seven eagles.
I guess it could be the four elements, too, with the fifth, you know, kind of unifying them all.
Yeah, it could be that. You know, with symbols, like I said, these are kind of fluid symbols. The cube, though, can also represent the four... the four elemental forces,
right,
and then the two alchemical ones. So you have six. So you have fire, water, air, and earth, and then you have mercury and sulfur. You know,
So
I've heard it described as that. You know, I've kind of seen this cube repetition over and over again in different alchemical works. I don't think anybody that I've run across so far, it doesn't mean it's not out there, has a very complete explanation of the cube, but I just kind of run into these little snippets here and there. So it can either have to do with the Philosopher's Stone, and in a way the cube kind of represents solidity, three-dimensionality, you know, whereas some of the other ones, other shapes don't. I mean, they can be three dimensional, but the cube is kind of, you know, has that idea of three different directions of the axis, you know, X, Y, Z axis. So, so three dimensionality is, you know, kind of has to do with that drawing of the ether and making it solid in a way, you know. A square is also in Masonic symbolism is known as the lodge, so is the house, I guess you could say. Not sure how that's significant. I just a little fractured factoid there. But
I used to be big into the cube symbolism. It's big on YouTube. People connect it with Saturn. You know, there's that popular.
Well, YouTube and Saturn.
But basically, you're supposed to represent matter or like time, you know. So it's basically how the, I guess God is kind of like kind of a little bit Gnostic, but kind of how God descended into matter, you know, which is represented in the cube because it's the three directions,
right?
It's the three.
That's exactly what I was getting at. And but going back to the alchemical symbol for copper. Copper is a red metal, okay? So there's a couple of different red metals. Gold, I guess, is considered a red metal. But copper, definitely, they described it as red. And so it has that sense of sulfur, okay? So you have the mercury and the sulfur, and then the ankh, you know, meaning eternal life, definitely has to do with the Philosopher's Stone.
Right.
So, I mean, for me, that was just so esoteric. There was no reason for it in the film. Whoever put that symbol together. Now, if it was just some kind of little copper, you know, bangle or bell or something, I probably wouldn't think much of it.
Right.
But you know, I'm pretty familiar with alchemical symbols, and that's why I paused it. I was like, that's a symbol.
Right.
And then, so I looked at it a little closer, and I was like, that's a symbol for copper. Why would they put that in there? So they were kind of communicating that their movie had alchemical overtones is what I think. I don't see a lot of alchemical overtones in the rest of the story, you know.
Right.
Nothing more than in a general sense.
Right, but, right.
Another curious one, and I think I mentioned this story, was the story of Ophiris the giant. And eventually how he carries Christ across this raging river, and he almost drowns because Christ becomes very heavy. You know, he was a Christ child. And that story is the Catholic story of St. Christopher. Okay, so he becomes the Christ carrier. That's what Christopher means. And I was actually watching The Green Mile a couple weeks ago, and it just hit me that John Coffey represents that giant Ophiris And at first I was like, well, okay, just because he's a giant and he's, you know, black and he's got the name Coffee doesn't necessarily make it alchemical.
Mm-hmm.
But then what he, you know, they break him out of jail and they take him to the warden's house where he heals that woman that mm-hmm. has, you know, something wrong with her. And, but remember how he does it. He has kind of like this inner light that
yeah.
gives life, you
yep.
know?
Yep.
And, you know, he revives the mouse. He makes the one of the guards live long, you know, an abnormally long life because he gives him some of his energy.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it also struck me that that woman had red hair. So you could play back and forth. Either she represents, I don't think she represents a sulfur principle because she's a female.
Right.
And so that doesn't really fit for me.
Mm-hmm.
But her being healed and kind of given life, that's definitely within the realm of the gold,
mm-hmm.
being a red metal, and then also being given life again
mm-hmm.
through basically, you know, John Coffey represents the philosophical Mercury, because the
right.
black stage comes after the union of the Mercury and Sulfur. So really it's a young philosopher's stone. You know, so it has the light in it, essentially. But here's the kicker, okay? So she comes back to life, and she gives him a gift of a little medallion, a necklace. And that's when I had to pause, too, because I'm like, okay, what is the necklace? Well, it's a necklace of St. Christopher.
Wow.
So I was just like, all right, that's not a mistake. And I think that... Stephen King does that in the book, too, because I tried to look it up, and I don't think that was accidental.
Sure.
But those are little Easter eggs, I think, that, you know, authors that do a lot of research are familiar with these themes. And whether they understand the full extent of the symbols or not, they put them in there. It gives their writing more depth, and it, you know, those are Easter eggs for people to find, I think.
Hmm.
So, the last movie... Oh, go ahead.
I got a question. You keep mentioning philosophical Mercury. How would you distinguish that from just regular Mercury?
Well, I think there's a progression there. So after you combine the sulfur with the Mercury, you end up with a new Mercury. And remember, Mercury, in my opinion, just represents a substance.
Right.
So the philosophical Mercury is different than the initial Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
I think it, yeah, I could be wrong about this, but I think it's synonymous with philosophical gold.
So the sulfur dies, and you end up with just the philosophical mercury?
Yeah, exactly.
In its place? Okay.
Yep.
Huh.
Yep. And I think it has the same meaning as philosophical gold. So
mm-hmm.
when they're tacking that adjective on there, philosophical, I think what they're doing is they're just trying to say, well, it's not literally Mercury, and it's no longer our Mercury, you know, the philosopher's Mercury. It's now become something different, so they're changing the name again to distinguish it from their initial Mercury.
Hmm.
And none of this is to be confused with the metal Mercury. That's what makes it all confusing. So you
yeah.
have three Mercuries there. You have the metal, you have the initial substance, and then you have the combined substance, and they're all called Mercury.
Right.
This is why... the alchemists can get away with confusing you
mm-hmm,
when
mm-hmm.
you read, you know, because
mm-hmm.
when they mention mercury, you have to stop and say, what are they talking about there? You know?
Right.
Was that the only question you had about that, Chris?
Yeah. Yep.
The last one I kind of threw together just real quick, was and I read these books way back when I was in high school, the whole Dune series. I don't think there's any mistake there. First of all, worms are generally seen as alchemical anyways. They kind of, you know, burrow through the earth and they transform the earth. And so those have always been kind of associated with alchemy.
Mm-hmm.
So these are giant worms, if you remember the story of Dune, that travel around on this desert planet, and it's a red planet, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And what you find out is about this ecosystem where these giant worms are kind of hunt down any moisture that's in the soil, and they scoop it up, and that's what makes the makes the planet so dry. But they end up creating this substance called the spice, and the spice is this red powder, or this red, they make it into these compressed sticks. Guess what it does? It gives you longer life, it expands consciousness, it makes the hero kind of almost into a Superman eventually. Paul Atreides. And his son ends up, you know, the whole rest of the series is about the God Emperor. So, you know, there's some themes there that I really haven't explored that much. But the baby worms, interestingly, Frank Herbert, had this whole little cycle where they take these baby worms and they kill them in their own water. Okay, they kill them in water.
Okay, yeah.
And then they spit out this stuff called the water of life that did kind of the same thing. It expanded consciousness, and it was a poison that they would drink and then transmute in their body. If you were able to transmute it, it was kind of a sign that you were ready to move on to a new stage. So in the story in Dune, traditionally only the women were able to do that. So Paul was like the first man that did it and transmuted that water. And that's what expanded his consciousness. So some interesting alchemical themes there. Again, I'm not sure how much Frank Herbert understood the true meaning, but he definitely had, taking the water of life name, that's, you know, directly taken from the idea of the mercury or the elixir of life, you know. I didn't get caught off guard this time, Chris. I have a giant bottle of water sitting next to me.
So. That's good.
But the whole story is about his transformation and the transformation of the planet, ironically, you know, because they're attempting to kind of terraform the planet and turn it into a lush environment, not realizing they're cutting off their own source of the spice, you know. There's also kind of this theme where they're always drinking their own water. Again, you go back to that Aurora Boris of eating its own tail. So, you know, the worm is literally doing that. He's, you know, these giant worms are going around kind of in circles, you know, attracted to water or noise, you know. So those are all the movie, you know, metaphors I had. But I'm sure there's a lot more. You brought up one. I think I thought about it, and for some reason it just didn't click with me, was the Tesseract, you know?
Yeah.
That's a really good one. So, you know, I had some phrases here. One of the ones I mentioned last time, and I felt a little foolish that I couldn't do it off the top of my head, but then I looked at how long the Latin phrase was, and remember I was talking about saltpeter, the salt of the stone, how these people mistook that, and they were literally using a substance that was saltpeter. They do the same thing with this substance called vitriol. And I'm not going to get into what vitriol, you know, is as an actual substance, but there are different substances that are called vitriols, okay? But it's also a anagram for an alchemical motto. I'm going to try and say it in Latin here. I've got it right in front of me. It says, Visita interiora terra. This is a word I have problems with. Rectificando invenis occultum lapidum. So that is literally Latin for visit the interior of the earth, and rectifying or purifying, you will find the hidden stone. So that, to me, is a very, very poignant statement of the entire work.
It's very reminiscent. It's very reminiscent of the Emerald Tablet.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
But look at all the symbols we're talking about. You know, the idea of smog coming out of the interior of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
That idea of purifying also has a sense of dying, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's really what that means, the purification.
Mm-hmm.
And you will find the hidden stone. So, again, you have that idea of drawing the mercury out of a substance.
Purifying it
with the sulfur.
Right.
And then that conjunction makes the rebus, or the philosopher's stone.
Interesting.
That motto came from somewhere. I didn't, you know, that's not something somebody made up. There is an alchemist named Basil Valentine.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a little treatise called the Azoth of the Philosophers, mm-hmm. or the Philosophies, I think it is. And that Azoth actually has an interesting connotation too, as I examined that word quite a bit. So what you have with Azoth is you have alpha, which is the beginning of the alphabet,
and then you have
Z, which is the end of the Latin alphabet.
Yeah.
You have omega, which the end of the Greek alphabet. And then you have Tau, which is the end of the Hebrew alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have in that little word is you have the beginning and three ends of the work. So
interesting.
You have that number three again that represent the three operations. So a word like Azoth has a lot of meaning just in its makeup, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that was an artificial word they created to describe their work.
Mm-hmm.
So, how's that one? I knew that one would kind of get you because I don't think you've heard that one before.
No, I like that one because I've always kind of liked that term, Azoth.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I think I mentioned this little phrase too. These are just different alchemical phrases I've run across and had to ponder. This is another one from Basil Valentine. The twofold fiery man must be fed a snowy swan. Then the swan roasted will become food for the king.
Mm.
And Basil Valentine goes on to say, if you can unravel that mystery, you can complete the whole science.
Mm.
So, good luck with that. Go out and buy some labware and get to work.
Mm-hmm.
There's another saying called one fire, one matter, one vessel.
Right. Uh-huh.
And as they describe the dryway, one of the things you run across is, well, one of the things that Fulcanelli describes is using a crucible over a naked fire. And given one matter, he says you can complete the work. Now, I'm not sure I completely believe him on that, but I came up with a theory that one fire, one matter, one vessel is all talking about the same thing. So you have this, you know, this secret fire. The vessel is often used as a description of the mercury in different ways. It's called the vessel.
Uh-huh.
And then, obviously, you know, one matter
kind
of describes this whole idea of a quintessence or one basic substrate to everything.
Right.
So, I don't think they're describing the operation there. I think they're describing, in three ways, they're describing the this ether, if you will. You know, one fire, one matter, one vessel.
Hmm.
That's all right. It's all right there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And and you have three distinct phases too of the work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the number three is represented in that phrase too.
Right.
Is what I'm saying. I'm not even sure I'm putting in the right chronological order. There may be a chronological you know, idea there too that I didn't really examine, but I don't know. Sometimes, like I said, sometimes you can get too close to this and over-examine it, and when I start doing stuff like that, I kind of step away and say, okay, well, maybe, but, you know, I don't have any evidence for that, so I just keep it stored in the back of my mind. And but if I run across it somewhere else, then I go, okay, what am I, you know, what am I looking at here?
Mm-hmm.
So, that's pretty much it on some of the phrases.
Mm-hmm.
I think we talked about solvit coagula earlier. One of the errors I did make in the last podcast, and, you know, if there's any alchemist out there that caught this error, then kudos to you, sir. But I said aqua regia was two acids, and I had the wrong acids. It's actually nitric acid and hydrochloric acid. That's what makes aqua regia. I think I said sulfuric acid. Like I said, nobody would probably even notice I made that error except myself when I went back and listened to it. And I was like, that's not the right,
yeah.
That's not the right thing. But, you know, there were some alchemists that were attempting to use these acids to dissolve gold.
Mm-hmm.
And then because they thought that the whole secret lied or lay in dissolving gold and manipulating that dissolved gold. So there was a reason that they developed that acid. And I think I mentioned before that that acid's used, or that combination of acids, is used in gold reclamation now, because it is one of the few things that does dissolve gold. And then you can kind of extract all the other impurities and then, reconstitute your gold from that acid.
Hmm.
So there's actually some cool videos on YouTube on how to do that. There are these private guys. I think it costs more on a small scale, to take computer chips and, you know, kind of dissolve them in this acid and then extract it. But there are a few guys out there that do this kind of stuff as a hobby, and they make, you know, maybe a gram or two of gold out of these computer chips.
Hmm.
Not really alchemy, but interesting.
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot of books last time, too. Some of the books I didn't mention last time, which are a little bit more related to... I would kind of just say they're more natural alchemy, and the term alchemy isn't even used in this book. It's called Secrets of the Soil.
Oh, yeah.
Peter Tompkins and Christopher Bird go through... the effects that they've seen through just kind of natural earth energies. So again, you know, you're talking about the same substance and they give it different names.
Right.
But they talk about burying. I think they use like horse's dung or something, or cow's dung, and they put in these cow's horns and then they bury it for, you know, several months or a year, and then they dig it back up and it makes this really great loam for growing plants.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do again with that putrefaction and more of a natural alchemy. One of our friends, you know, Steven, he might really get a kick out of that book because it has a lot of stuff that is kind of related to permaculture and, But one of the things I found really interesting, and one of the experiments I didn't mention last time that I did, and it's not really proof that this works, but what I got from that book was if you take these quartz crystals and you crush them up like into a powder,
mm-hmm.
and then you can make a water with them where you sprinkle it in water, and then I vortex the water, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this was actually the first time I grew a garden in my old house. I didn't really even know what I was doing. I just made these, you know, these beds. I didn't even make beds. I just kind of ripped up my backyard and made these furrows, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I just planted a bunch of stuff. I got some tomato seeds and zucchini starters, and I got way too many zucchinis. I think I bought 10 zucchinis.
Mm-hmm.
I had to pull like half of them, and still out of 5 zucchini plants, I think I was feeding the entire neighborhood.
Wow.
Yeah, these things just got huge. It was a great spot for the garden because the light hit it all day. And but what I did is I, you know, I took that ground up quartz and you know, really fine powder, and I put it in this water, and then I put some of this really old loam I had in the garden, you know, that had just been kind of stinky, you know, putrefying. I mixed it in there, and I sprayed this on my entire garden when I first planted. And to this day, I may have to revisit doing that again. To this day, I've never had as good a garden as that. I mean, everything grew huge. Everything was lush. Now, you know, I can't prove it was because of that little experiment, but the things that they described in the book worked, you know.
Right.
I mean, there could have been a lot of factors. Maybe I just planted at an opportune time.
Right.
Was it an especially good summer that year?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of different factors. But it did make me somewhat of a believer in that methodology. And my wife and I have always kind of had a green thumb. You know, I have a pretty good garden now I grow. And I need to probably go back and do this again and see if it changes on how things grow.
Plant growing in itself is just a great evidence of alchemy in nature.
Oh, yeah.
Because I took a few horticulture classes in school, and I remember my teacher describing how plants grow. He was basically saying, like, most of what plants get is just from the air.
Yeah.
Just from, like, nothing.
Yep.
You know?
Well, think
just,
about a tree.
Well, I thought about, I actually raised my hand, and I said, that sounds like alchemy. And he just kind of laughed and, like, you know, scoffed it off and was like, oh, we're not making gold here. And I just thought to myself, yeah, you're actually claiming something way more miraculous. You're claiming this complex living thing coming from, like, nothing.
It's well, just like, you know, the alchemists talk about examining nature, okay? And one of the things you got to, like, think about are, like, these really big trees, like redwoods or Doug firs or something like that.
Yeah, where's all the matter coming from?
Exactly. For the
amount
biomass.
Of soil, okay, you don't really have any soil lost, and the amount of water that they're getting, well, the thing weighs way more than how much water it ever gets, so where's all this matter coming from?
Yeah, it's essentially coming from the air.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're drawing in carbon from the air and nitrogen from the soil and from the air, and I mean
it's transmutation
too. They're you know, in some ways it's a chemical process, but I think in the most fundamental sense it is a transformation of energy, because what you're getting, the plants have to take in the photons,
yep,
and they have to translate those photons into electrochemical energy.
Right.
And that is an incredible process. I mean, you know, one of the things that, you know, the Book of Romans talks about is, you know, how people can see creation or see the creator in the creation.
Right.
And I think those are those mechanisms that are so incredible can only be really invented by an intelligent mind. You know, the idea of random chance is just so ludicrous.
No. Uh-uh.
It doesn't even play out mathematically. I mean, it's just...
No.
But for me, you know, examining alchemists, and I think we need to give another shout out to the medieval alchemists for being, you know, for the most part, Christians and not occultists or...
we can talk about photons a little bit just to comment on those. So basically all this matter is coming from light being transmuted.
Yeah. Right.
So light is actually becoming matter, okay? You know? So
Right. Well, at least it's forming the bonds for matter, because you know, if we're going to posit the idea that it's taking in all these different you know, atoms of carbon and things from the air, and then, but it needs the energy to hold the bonds together, the chemical bonds, and that's where the photons come in. So I don't know if it's actually, you know, it is, you know, foundationally forming the building blocks of matter.
Well, what are the chemicals, though? Those are all just different Those are light as well, aren't they?
Right. That's what I'm saying. The yeah. chemical bonds are literally, you know, shared electrons.
Right.
So they're
right.
You know, they're getting, you know, they're taking light and they're, you know, you got to speculate where those electrons are coming from. Is there's ambient electrons or it's an however you want to slice it up. It's an incredible process of either taking photons and turning them into electrons or using the photonic energy to draw in electrons. I don't care how you describe it, but it's still a process of, you know, rearranging matter. And that's essentially what
in an intelligent way
all about. Yeah.
It's, you can't have that and not have intelligence.
Right.
Well, I was having a conversation with one of my friends about atheists and alchemy, like how basically if you're a materialist, you should believe in alchemy, you know, because they supposedly believe in these laws, you know, like the law of thermodynamics, you know, like energy can't be created or destroyed, you know.
Right.
Yet they don't believe it. They should believe in alchemy, you know.
Right.
Energy can't go anywhere. It just transforms. It's just, why don't you believe right. in alchemy, you know? It's just,
yeah.
It makes no sense. So,
I was also interested, you know, just kind of a random thought, but I was thinking about Isaac Newton, and, you know, he was very steeped into the alchemical arts, and,
yeah.
and nobody ever thinks that he discovered the Philosopher's Stone, and he really got hooked into this idea of making an antimony regulus with iron, and he thought that that was important. And I've read papers where they have taken iron and antimony and attempted to make some kind of new amalgam that they feel is the mercury or the philosophical mercury. But I think that's a dead path. But I thought it was interesting that, you know, some of the names that we recognize as forming the foundation of modern science were, you know, steeped into alchemy. I mean, guys like
yeah.
Roger Bacon and, again, Isaac Newton and, you know, the medieval alchemists were, even if they weren't true alchemists, even if they were puffers and they were making mistakes, I was talking to, you know, one of our friends, Chris, and I used that term puffer. He goes, "What's a puffer?" And I was going, "Well, what they did, see, is they had these little devices, you know, these, what do you call those? The bellows to make their Athanors hot, you know, and
oh,
keep
yeah.
the fires
yeah.
going. So
right.
the true alchemists would call the fake alchemists puffers because
I see, yeah.
They were always, you know, in their laboratory puffing on their fires. Mm-hmm. And but it's actually the puffers where we get a lot of modern science, which I think is kind of ironic, because from their mm-hmm. mistakes, we got chemical substances that were not the Philosopher's Stone or were not on the path to the Philosopher's Stone, but became useful. So I think what happened was scientists became, you know, kind of conscious of this, realizing they weren't going to be able to make the stone, but they made a useful substance, and then they would kind of market it and sell those things. And so it became financially more important to, you know, try to standardize, you know, what they were dealing with. And, you know, chemical science was born, and, you know, a lot of useful substances and dangerous substances, you know, came out of that.
Hmm.
But I used to know a whole bunch of them off the top of my head. I'll have to sit down sometime and make a list of all the useful substances that we got actually from mistaken alchemical substances. Phosphorus is one, by the way. You know, that luminescent phosphorus.
Yeah, yep.
As I recall, it was a mistake,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know. But, well, I've kind of exhausted all the topics I wanted to cover, unless you had, you know, another quote there, or if you had another question for me.
We could talk about the properties of the stone, if people
oh,
are
yeah,
interested.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. So, you know, once you have the Philosopher's Stone, what do you do with it, and what is it good for? You know, we mentioned kind of life extension as a theme. Fulcanelli says not to get too far off the deep end. He seems to imply that there are definitely limitations. You know, yeah, it will give you back some youth, but it's not going to make you, you know, 20 again. And he seems to indicate that it's not going to give you eternal life, but it may extend your life. You
know? Well, see, that's what I found interesting in this book, is some of the alchemists would say that it doesn't, yeah, it doesn't give you eternal life, but it just restore, it basically gives you the life of, like, some of the patriarchs before the flood, you know? Mm-hmm. Like,
right.
So it makes me wonder if there's possibly some genetic trigger that God, like, put in everybody that just determines when they're going to die, like, regardless of, you know, we all just have a limit, you know, regardless right. of anything else, or, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, another possible theory is that the alchemists, you know, they were getting a lot of this information, you know, deductively, or they inherited it.
Yeah.
So they may have not done too much experimentation with what they had. You know, they may have been told, this is how you take it. Don't take it any other way, because it's dangerous, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that may have limited the possibilities to fully get the benefit from it. I mean, maybe if they had taken more for a longer period of time, they would have got more benefit. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just speculating. But it's possible they didn't, you know, examine enough of what they were doing to experiment around and try to do different things for that fear. Because I know I've read that you can take too much and harm yourself or even kill yourself, you know.
The yeah.
We all talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's one theory I had. The other one is, you know, I did speculate about that God just limited it, and no matter how much you take, you know, you're kind of limited on how much extension you can have. Like mm-hmm. it changed just somehow genetically.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'll have to make it someday and then figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was looking for, you know, I wanted to read something out of this Rosicrucian notebook, because he actually talks quite a bit about the Philosopher's Stone. And,
well, I can just read off these headings from this book just to give people kind of just a basic idea of some of the properties.
Yeah, well, one of the other properties,
chapters.
Too. Yeah, before you do that, you know, obviously there's the practical application of, you know, turning metal into base metals into gold.
Yeah.
But see, they didn't realize that they had, if they could do transmutations, and I've never read this anywhere, is it possible to transmute aluminum into platinum, for instance? You know, I mean, you know, so there's a lot of experimentation that's possible now that we do have the benefit of modern science. If somebody were to, you know, reinvent this, then what are the possibilities? Because gold, you know, yeah, it's worth a lot, but it's not as worth as much as platinum, you know?
Interesting.
So there's other possibilities there.
Mm-hmm. Kind of frightening if this gets into the wrong hands.
Well, again, that's one of the...
Which kind of begs,
you know,
the question.
Yeah, the ethical reasons that these philosophers hid what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I think most people, if they got to that point, they would realize, you know, the damage they could do by, you know, revealing that secret too much. So
yeah. Well, it says the final stone is very heavy. Apparently, it is extremely dense. The final stone is incombustible. The final stone is crystalline. The final stone is soluble in any liquid. The stone is a universal medicine or panacea. The stone prevents the appearance of age and restores of old age and restores youth. The stone prolongs life. The stone cures sorrow. The stone transmutes metals.
One yeah. interesting application I don't run across too much is changing certain crystals into precious gems. So
yeah,
that is mentioned
that another,
a few times.
That's another thing that's in here, the stone transmutes gems.
Yeah. And you know, I couldn't even speculate how they do that. They may be able to liquefy it and then kind of cook, you know, a gemstone in the Philosopher's Stone. And that's how they would do that. That's just a speculation on my part. But there isn't a lot written on that. It's just written that they could do that. There's also a story of a man that made glass malleable so he could take, you know, break a glass and then kind of like reshape it and and fix it. I think he was killed. So the story goes. That's one of those stories that I think was in the Rosicrucian notebook. So, you know, gem transmutation is not one I read a lot about. I think I've seen the philosophers talking about how easy it is to transmute silver into gold, whereas a lot of people think that, you know, the stories you hear are always lead into gold. But silver, alchemically, is much closer to gold.
Yeah.
And so it if you have access to silver, it's actually easier and less expensive to do. Because it doesn't take as much of your Philosopher's Stone to push it over the edge. And this has nothing to do with atomic structure at all, because atomically, lead is similar to gold. That's why some scientists speculate, you know, that it is possible with, you know, nuclear reactors to do this. But alchemically, silver is closer. So that has more to do with the makeup of this internal mercury and sulfur. So you have enough in the stone to push mercury. You know, I can't recall off the top of my head, but it's lacking the purity of one of the elements there, of either sulfur or mercury in it. So adding the Philosopher's Stone to it can push it. Now, according to the alchemists, if you add too much of the stone to any metal, you'll just create more of the stone.
Right.
So that's why if you apply it to gold, it doesn't turn into anything but more stone. So
exactly.
You know,
right.
That's part of the multiplication idea, is that you use gold to multiply it, which I believe is the third step. So, because they talk about not combining it with gold until you reach the red stage. So you're not taking the white stone that you have, the philosophical mercury, and combining it with gold yet. At least I don't think so.
Yeah, you gotta wait till the white germinates into the red before you...
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, we're coming up on about 2 hours here, Chris. So I think we should maybe just kind of wrap it up here, unless you got another thing to talk about.
I think that was about it.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, everybody, at Outlaw Nation. Again, if you have any questions or comments, you can reach us at outlawnation7@gmail.com. And you've been listening to the Fringe Radio Network.
You are listening to the Outlaw Nation on the Fringe Radio Network. FringeRadioNetwork.com.